What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hapness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I am on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Tom Goldhand, a dancer and dance teacher. And we speak about facilitating dance classes and what we can learn from dancing about communication and leadership. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And now, lean back to be inspired. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Miriam.
I am so excited to have you here because I was in one of your workshops. And to give the audience a little bit of context, it wasn't a business verbal workshop. It was a dance improvisation workshop. Mm-hmm. And the moment you stepped in and set the space, I knew two things. One was I want to learn dancing from you. And second was I want to learn more about how you facilitate.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very, very nice to hear from both sides. I really like what I do. I like to share dance and movement, basically movement with awareness. That's my definition for dance. And facilitation is something that I think acquired the skills in the last roughly 10 years. Mm. So it's nice to hear that it's really coming from you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the audience has to find out for themselves, but for the facilitation, we can learn together. Yeah. When did you start calling yourself a facilitator?
It's funny because I don't use that word so often. I use it mostly as a teacher. I'm a teacher of dance, and the facilitation is in the background. So people who are facilitators, who are more into that, they will recognize it. And people who are, call themselves mostly teachers will recognize the other aspects. And facilitation for me is basically the way that you're holding space and allowing knowledge to be shared and to be passed through you and between the people. So I just consider that holding space for teaching, for sharing knowledge. If you do it correctly, or if you do it very well, and they don't see it. So I think a lot of my, let's say, clients, students, people who come to me, they will not see that as a facilitator in my classes or workshops, but they will see that they came for a very nice dance or movement workshops and it worked. Mm. And they come out of it with a very different feeling. And I think that's also why people come or stay, because it's not only about the material. Sometimes call a good teacher, and we can change that word for facilitator here, that they need to have three realms to, let's say, semi-master. And that's the physical, I call it the physical, the psychological, and for lack of a better word, spiritual or being or awareness. The first part is the physical, so you need to know your material. You need to have a certain degree of, let's say, acquaintance or mastery of what you want to give. The psychology is the ability to hold space for the people to be able to get it. So to notice the psychological aspect of where they are, especially in movement, because it's all visible in the body. Frustration, enjoyment, tiredness. And again, spiritual awareness, you need to have a wish for them to be as good or better than you. Mm. And you said that, and that's your intention, and that's the qualities that you bring, then it's a good workshop. And then the material can pass very easily.
Beautiful. Thank you for putting this into context. Mm-hmm. And I'm just amazed by how much this applies to any workshop facilitation, independent whether it's dance or more the intellectual, then it's not the physical, but maybe the intellectual content that you try to pass on. And I'm curious, I would like to dig deeper into what you said about the psychological. So everyone comes to your workshop with their own baggage.
Yeah, hopes and fears.
Yes. And how do you sense that? And how do you integrate or how do you adjust your material and the structure of what you do depending on what the space offers you?
Yeah. So first of all, you need to see where they are in their bodies physically. What's their comfort in the movement material that we do. That's very visible for me, the way they enter the room. So sometimes postures, their face, the way that they greet you, the way that you greet them, and how they respond. So all of these non-verbal cues are much more important than the verbal cues. Where they sit in space, how they sit in space, if they're interacting with others, if they're lying down, if they're against the wall, if they're close to me or further away. All of these, it's like we are a group of community of, let's say, animals, because it's an animalistic language or body language. And once you recognize that, you really know where people are. So this is like the first year, and I'm not sure about this. This is a hype. Every time I do, this is what I'm thinking. In the beginning, it is, of course, with projection and all of that stuff. So then after that, I'm bringing everybody together. Let's do a check-in. Again, you ask people to come in, you see who come in running and who is lagging behind and who is all of this very small queue. Saying their names, you know you've been there, so you know that I ask everybody to say the name for two reasons. And one is actually for more than two reasons, but one is to actually say your name to the space. So the space gets to know you, you get to know them, and to see how you communicate that to others. If you approach it to me or to the group. The second thing is like, how fast is it? So this is the big, big body. So if everybody's going very, very, very fast with the names, there's high tension level in the group. If everybody's relaxed, they take a breath after every name. Then it's still just the way that they say it. And then I ask for a small energy level. You also notice that probably in my workshop. If you're tired, you place in that. If you're ready to play, you place it in the middle. And if you're hyper, you place your hand very high. So then I check if I'm right. So, okay. And people see each other again. So all of these things are small cues that I tap into and they tap into unconsciously. So they see who's hyper, and if they're hyper, they will meet. They will want to meet. If two people are very tired, they might meet or want to meet as well. And energies kind of sometimes either tend to consciously meet each other at the same level or unconsciously at the same level or opposite.
Mm.
Yeah, so this is like how I see it in the beginning. And then what you try to do is you try to equalize it as a group. So the people who are really tired, you need to bring them into some kind of level of awareness, which is a little bit more up. And the people that are hyper, you try to ground them a little bit more and slow them a little down to create what I call a cohesive space. If the space is very, very bubbly, call it, it's kind of tough to bring material in. Because
there's no attention?
It's not that no attention, it's the attention is scattered and the energy level of the attention is very, very in different directions, which means the hyper people, for example, will be much more social and engaging fast. And the people who have less energy or much more inward, they will have a hard time hearing what I'm saying or engaging with it. So you need to bring the people who are much more, in Dutch, let's say, being in the token or inward, going inward, a little bit more up. And the people who are completely out there and running, jumping, bringing lots of, say, fireworks into the studio, just a little bit calm down. This will change, but you need that for the beginning. So the beginning, you create a cohesive, semi-cohesive group. And then when people are meeting each other later on, you can again divide or go into your own energy later.
And again, I find this fascinating because I think this is very often a step that we tend to forget when we're in the verbal space.
Yeah.
Because we're working with similar energies. Some are very excited and have lots of energy and want to get to work, and others are drained because we don't know what has happened to them before. And to be aware of that and to create this cohesiveness and to prepare the group so that they can then work together from a similar stage, I think is very important. So how do you do that?
Well, what you just said about that, that's really, really important, because if not, it creates conflicts. It creates misunderstanding in the group and it creates a lack of will to work together. Once you have that set, people will bring their gift. So I need, every group needs the fireworks. Every group needs the contemplative person. Every group needs that. But when they can reach and hear each other, then they can bring their gift in a very different way. The way that I do that is usually in walking. There's a few ways. My classical way of doing it is walking, because I really see a lot of what's going on in the space. You see who bumps into who. You see how they walk. You see if it's lethargic weight, which means they're tired, or if they're not grounded and they're walking on the forefront of their feet. There's a lot of things that really can happen. And then as you add a little bit more information, usually I ask them to go either faster or to add more body parts. You see also how much information they can process.
Mm.
The eyes and the way that they breathe is the biggest indication. And you will hear me in class constantly saying, eyes are up, not to the floor. Notice in your breath, relax your jaw. These are my little key phrases that everybody knows in my classes. And they give it sometimes back to me. Because with that, you can open. You can really, really open. And it balances the entire group. Now, of course, the group knows how to do that because they come quite a long time with me. So newbies is really interesting to see, because it can bring the sympathetic, the fight or flight, the attention and fight or flight system a little bit more up. If you're walking in a group and you're almost going bumping or going fast, and then you really see how they can handle it. So I always say, if this is your first time, go in the periphery. Breathe there, and once in a while, go into the washing machine inside where there's a lot of people. And that's how I feel new people. And then from that, we slow down, and we start to meet each other. Usually what happens when you're going into a little bit more of an arousal state physically, not sexual, but arousal of energy, right? Much more heartbeat a little bit higher than 70 or 80, and slowing down, sensitivity kicks in. Sensitivity in the way that you can process information from your senses in a better way. So you brought more information by moving, slow down, then tac, 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 tac. It's like a small body scan as you move. And then they become more sensitive to the body, to themselves and to others. And the way that they play in space, not necessarily in contact, because you came to a physical contact dance way, but I do that in all of my workshops. This applies, and after that, it goes to dance and exercises and the material that I want to bring. This applies in most of the case. That's how I start. Unless you sense that more than 50% of the group is very tired, then you need to go with the group, which means you will start on the floor, or you will start with breathing, or you start with meditation. If you will try to push more than 30, 40, and definitely more than 50% of the energy of the group in your way rather than their way, you will suffer, the group will not go with you, and you are basically missing the point.
And that's very, very insightful. And just for me to understand, so if the group is low in energy, you would basically meet them where they are, so with slower meditation, and then slightly build the energy up together?
Yeah.
And then with a group that is 50% high in energy, would you then do the opposite, that you go into high intensive movement?
No, actually, it's not. The both edges, like completely lethargic, tired from the day, you will go into the flow, you will go from there. And the people who are, if the entire group is after two cups of coffee and very, very hyper, you will do the same.
Mm.
You will stand and you will meditate. You want to bring everybody to a cohesive, roughly bell-shaped curve, you want to be in the middle. Usually, when a group comes, there are a few people who are hyper, a few people who are very tired, have an emotional process, and the majority is in the middle. So they join the majority, or they sit, which is fine, sit outside. When the entire group, or the majority, or above 50, is on each of these sides, you need to address it in a different way. You need to really bring them to a more sympathetic, not lethargic, but sorry, parasympathetic, like relaxing place, and from there starting.
Mm.
And usually after that, there will come either some exercises or back to an engagement with walking, but you start differently. I have to say that if I remember correctly, in my group, for the last 2 years, let's say, it doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. I have my sticks and my own patterns already, that I know it's works, that I know how to do that. They are also very aware of that. So they know, like, okay, we walk, here we go. And sometimes I need to surprise also myself. We do different. We do it in a different way to reach the same goal, but in a different way.
Interesting. Before I go into a different direction, I remember you saying that you did workshops online during the lockdown. How did you replicate such an exercise online?
You don't. So the online is challenging in a way, in many ways, especially for dance classes. Contact is not possible to do online, or some people have done it. I tried it once in a class where I went, and I felt very, very, let's say, not happy with the result. So I said, I'm not going to do that. But dancing and movement and way of communicating and connection can be done. The walking in between doesn't work, of course, because you don't have any interaction. But you do the same process, like saying the names or seeing each other, mentioning on the screen, where is your energy level? Because it's not only for other people to see that, it's for you to recognize. You're contemplating where I am now. And you need to know it in order to show it. Sometimes people will take some time and like, okay, where am I? And then the warm-up is individual. So I need to show, which usually I don't show a lot. Everybody takes a few steps away from the screen, and we start to open in a body scan and movement the rest of the body. And then you play in your kitchen, living room, or your own room with space. And this is the warm-up. It's much harder to engage, but if you have people who come for a class, they want to be different.
Yeah.
And then the intercommunication between people comes after, in a way that you do it in either a breakout room, or you put one person or your partner on the big screen and you dance and communicate via visual sense.
I love to do that in workshops for nonverbal communication, just mirroring each other. It's magic.
True. Yeah.
And the fact that trust.
You create connection while you know that the other person is very far away from you gives a very different sensation.
Yeah. Which makes me now curious about the contact versus no contact improv. So as you mentioned, I was in your class where contact, well, maybe I let you explain the difference between contact improv and...
Yeah. So contact improvisation is a dance form, modern dance form that was created 50 years ago. It has a very big philosophy behind it, which we probably will not go here now. But the form basically requires two bodies, let's call it like that, two dancers. And they share in physical connection information about their weight, how they lean into each other, how they move, and physicality, which means momentum or gravity. It sounds very weird when I describe it like this, but it basically means two people dancing in physical contact with different parts of their body, on the floor, up, down, can carry each other, can lift each other. And it can be very, very acrobatic or very slow and intentive and attentive. The difference between this and dance improvisation is that dance improvisation is a bigger world that includes in contact. And it doesn't have to be constantly in physical contact. And the emphasis there is much more of awareness to, let's say, four things. Your own body, the intercommunication and playful with one partner, space, where do you put yourself in composition, the big group, which means if it's more than just one partner, how the a group of 6, 7, 8 people improvise and move together to create a dance piece that sometimes feels not improvised and looks better than choreography. These are rare moments, but those are the moments where it's like everybody feels that they're in the flow, on the zone, and something came from above. And the last thing is mostly for professional dancer is the performative aspect of the form, which is basically to actually put on a show, a dance show, where almost everything is improvised. And sometimes there are some fixed anchors or predetermined decisions. So contact was invented from improvisation because nothing is fixed there. But the premises of it is physics. Simply two bodies dancing together with physical contact.
Thank you for that. A little bit of context.
Yes.
And what I find fascinating, or what I'm very curious about, is how does communication work differently in both forms? Because in the, as you say, in the contact improv, it's physics, so I can feel the resistance, and there's always, we don't need words because we feel where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no touch point, how do dancers then communicate, and how do you facilitate that?
Well, first of all of the communication travels through many different mediums. So, of course, if there is touch, what you're referring to the communication is usually the physical communication, mm-hmm. the weight. Sometimes you can also sense intention with touch or the place where the person is regarding to that medium. But a lot of communication is conveyed also in normal, let's say, meetings, and most of it is not verbally. So some people say like it is 70%, 80%, doesn't matter, but the majority of the communication that happens between people is non-verbally. And your body resonates it unconsciously, which means if a person is very tense, their breath is high, their gaze is down, and you meet them and they talk to you, even if they would say, well, I'm very, very happy, your body doesn't believe it. And unconsciously, you pick that energy. It's called physical resonance or kinesthetic empathy. So when you're dancing and somebody will come very, very fast, your unconscious conditioning is to attach that level of energy and to move similarly. The best example in business world is when you're giving a handshake, you will match the strength roughly and the way that your partner is giving you a handshake. So if you will feel somebody who's really has a firm handshake or a strong one, you will immediately engage more to balance it. And if you have a dead hand person, it's like, okay, it feels weird. What we usually do, if we don't have like a very strict form of giving a handshake, if we are adaptable or playing but listening, we will adjust the way that we are handling this meeting. So yeah, a lot of the communication happens through space, through vision, peripheral vision, and for stuff that you don't even see, but you feel.
And
the
then,
space that, yeah. Yeah, so
mm-hmm.
the
nope,
space
go ahead.
You, the space that you take, the space, if people take much more space, you will see people take going out of the space. You will see the conditioning about introvert, extrovert, the use of space, the use of level of different body parts and different heights. If somebody wants to go first, they will usually enter the scene. And there's always the people who jump second. And there's always the one that will wait quite a long, and only if it's needed will intervene or go into the space to add something. And there's always the one that will add anyway, no matter what. If there's a lot of stuff in the scene, they will jump in as well.
And again, I can see the equivalent of that in a verbal workshop, for no better words. And especially as a teacher, you want the shy ones also to join and to contribute more. So the shy voices or the shy bodies, and maybe you want the more dominant ones to leave more space and to calm down. What are the tricks that you are using? Because I think asking someone to dance in the group as one of the first when they're actually shy is even more intimidating when it comes to dancing, which is something very personal and vulnerable, than to speaking.
Yeah.
What are your tricks?
First of all, they need to recognize that in themselves, and they want to give themselves permission to do that. So if that comes from me, that will come as not only a challenge, but also a demand, and that can bring more walls. So there's a few things. For example, you know, we do this, everybody's sitting and everybody bringing some stuff to the fire, or I ask people to bring stuff into the fire if they can recognize stuff from their body. And there will always be the person that comes first or shares something first. And if that is a pattern, I can use that very easily to say, we are in a dance improvisation class. Our aim for the class is to expand your pattern, which means notice them and expand them. So if you're the person who's always jumping first, take 10 seconds of breath and make sure that you're not the one who goes first. And if you've never jumped into the bringing stuff into the fire and you notice that, this is your opportunity. Mostly I will not pressure people to do that. And sometimes, very rarely, I will ask, like, what's your opinion? Or did you have something like addressing it with names?
Mm.
That. On the dance floor, I'm a little bit more tough, let's say. So if somebody keeps on coming in for the first time or takes a lot of space, I will first say, look at what you're doing. And if it keeps on coming, it's like, no, come back, wait. Very strict, like feel it. And they don't like me at that point, which is fine. This is the place where facilitator changing to teacher. And if they need that and it works, I'll come back to facilitator, do what you want. It's about recognizing your pattern and then choose it. If you don't recognize your patterns, then you're doing it unconsciously. And that's not the aim of the class, or we don't grow from it. And with people who don't want to come in, those are the shy buddies, let's call it like that, shy people, I will invite them to do that. You go first. Jump into the water. And they will feel that it's an invitation, not a demand. So they always have a possibility to say no.
Mm.
Because, yeah, I usually say that in the class, there's a few teachers. There's me as a facilitator that leads the entire big body. There's your partners that help you see what you cannot see. And there's your body. And when me and your body are fighting over something, when we are in Dutch boxing, I like that word, when we are fighting about something, which I say, let's do that, and your body says no, your body always wins. The ability to hear their body and actually acknowledge it and say no is great. And if they say no to me, I'm even happier, because that means that's a safer space or a safe enough space for them to say no to the power authority in the room. So they can take care of themselves even from the biggest power in the room, which is the teacher or the facilitator.
Beautiful. Yeah. And to give permission, basically, to set boundaries and to listen to your own needs. That's very helpful. And I would like to come back to the fire, because the audience might miss a piece of information.
Yeah.
And it was actually, this was the moment where I saw your facilitation skills when you did that. And maybe you want to share your signature exercise, if I may call it like this. That's a typical Tom, right?
Sorry?
That's a typical Tom.
Yes, yes. I don't think I took it from somebody. Some of the stuff, of course, I take from other teacher or facilitators, and I try to give credit to that. But I don't think I saw that elsewhere, and I really liked it. So it came from my body. And what we do is basically we create a, I call it, when we create a circle, we create a mythical fire in the middle. And the fire works in a very nice way. We need to keep it alive. So from time to time, we bring logs of wood from our body into the fire. And those logs can be either sensation, realization, questions, feelings, everything that is alive in you, you bring to the fire. So there's no negative or positive here. I always say that questions are very, very welcome, and I don't always answer. It's either I don't know the answer and I say so, or the answer comes from my body and it will not help your body. So open questions in my eyes are much, much, much more valuable than closed answers, because it keeps the research going. And people really like it. And sometimes they don't understand what's the fire, how does it work. And after a few times, you get the hang of it, and it keeps on the inquiry, the research, and the class. And I also know how to play more with information.
Yeah. And what I like about the analogy, so the fire is kept alive through verbal pieces of wood, and everyone contributes. So it's basically, it's a shared responsibility to keep this fire alive. And a fire in a circle sitting around it is like, it keeps the group warm. So it nurtures the entire group, and everyone in the group is part of this process.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that nothing is commented is a regular check-in for the situation, what needs to be voiced. Sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't, and it's okay. So I think it really helps to maintain the safe space that you realize everything I say and sense is okay to share.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This comes from facilitation technique or methods, also from therapy. So by creating that safe space that people are witnessing and not responding, people are able to say what they feel and want without knowing that nobody will interrupt them. accept me if it goes way beyond the scope of time, or that they will not get a reaction about it. And it works also both ways, because sometimes some groups, some people have a tendency of sharing only the good stuff. And I don't want only that. So if an exercise was shit, or if you had a bad experience, better pull it in. I don't get insulted. I'm with teaching and facilitation, I'm already in a place where please bring your bad shit. I don't get insulted. If you had like really bad class, it's fine. And they can also sometimes bring pain. It's like I need to put in the fire my shoulder pain. And then the fire works very different. We all say that if it's a positive thing, we all can take from the fire and we take it into our body. If it's a negative thing, the fire works brilliantly. It just burns it up. And then you see lots of people start to put, I have a knee pain, I have a headache, it's fine, burn it up.
Nice. And since you talked about bad workshops or bad experiences, what makes a workshop fail in your perspective?
Yeah. A workshop will fail. I don't like to use that word, but it is not successful in a sense if no one from the people who came, including myself, got something out of it. So in that sense, my bar is very low. If somebody learned something, if we could learn something from this, good enough. For example, my bar is even lower when we do very strong contact improvisation. I said, nobody died. It's a success.
Nobody injured.
It's a success. Exactly. Yeah. So in that sense, I need people to learn and I need myself as well to have a good learning experience. Usually it comes together. I don't remember when there was like a failed, let's say, workshop. I do remember workshops where it were hard to hold. And that's mostly emotional. Mostly emotional.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, of course. When people come with different expectation, when people come with some emotional processes that are not yet fully integrated, I mean, we are working with the body, so everything is stored there, and it's very easy to tap or open doors through movement, which sometimes doesn't happen in, let's say, verbal facilitation workshops, unless it's therapy workshop, and then it's very much oriented there.
Mm-hmm.
So my workshops is not orientated for therapy, but it's basically sometimes happening behind the scenes very, very clear. Now, I'm very happy that I have training there, so done dance therapy education, so I can notice the changes that happens, and then we are not going there, and basically skew it a little bit to the right or to the left. And sometimes it's either I miss the cues, or there's what we say, again, I like the word in Dutch, omploft the kip, like a person who pops for any reason. And of course, it affects the group, and you need to know how to handle it. So those are the challenging workshops. They're not a failed one, because you really expand the abilities for you to facilitate when you are handling difficult classes or facilitation sessions.
Yeah. There are two aspects that I'm very curious about. One is how to detect it and not to go that route. And the other one is how to, if it gets emotional, if stuff comes up, how to close it. Because both are situations that I can also refer to. Sometimes there's conflict coming up or there are triggers coming up, and then how to handle it in a way that it's not becoming therapy, because most of the audience, I think, are not therapists. And I would still be curious about the difference, how you would handle it in dance therapy and how to close it. Yeah.
So conflict usually doesn't happen between participants in dance session, in movement session. They will just go away.
Mm.
And their energy will not meet. They will not want to work together. When they do, they will find it unpleasant. Usually conflict is with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's addressed to me. And it's not full-blown conflict, although it can happen. You see it under the carpet. They will do stuff that is not helpful, not for them, not for the workshop, not for the group. Sometimes you use Aikido, I call it, the Aikido mm-hmm. movement. It's like, I see what you're doing. I will go with you. We'll change it a little bit and we'll come back. And sometimes you put them, you put it on the spot. And then it depends on the person. It depends on your interaction with them. I sometimes call myself a little bit more of a, I'm a soft and a tough teacher or facilitator in that sense. So the setting is very clear. And once you say yes to those settings, I have no problem with you going elsewhere, especially if you're doing it for your own research. If you're now not in a place that is beneficial for you, me, or the group, if it's one of them, it's fine. But if all three of them are not applicable, then you will get, I will say something into the space, not address it going up at them. For example, if I see somebody's grabbing and it's not okay to grab in different workshops, I would say, notice that you don't grab. Very simple. If they don't notice, I will come closer to them and say that. If they don't notice, then this comes.
You tap on the shoulder.
Yeah. And this comes because this is, and when everybody's doing something else, they don't see me addressing that person. So it's only me and him or me and her. If I will tell in the big space, punchy punchy, like their name, stop grabbing, then everybody's, all of the attention is on him or her. And then there's like, I'm a bad ta 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 ta. If I'm saying it in a different way, it's a guideline. Everybody knows it. Also, you open your eyes. There's a lot of time people close their eyes. You just say that again and again. And some people, I know that they really like it. So I'm tapping. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming closer to them. And I'm saying that. So these are the small things that I do with participants. When there's a high, I think I don't need like 3, max 5, high, big resistance and conflict between me and him or her, that's a tough one. That's a very, very tough one. I remember one class that person really said that this is not what I came for. And he has been with me for 3 years. So he comes every week. He used to come every week. So I know he gets something from the classes. We have hardly any contact verbally. And he follows every class. He followed every class. And then at one time, he was really annoyed because I was going into more of what I call the La La Land, which is we're working with movement with intention. And it's very hard to copy intention. Mm-hmm. It's like, I have mine, you have yours. And he said, no, this is not what I come from. I want to dance like this man or this woman. I want to be better at this. I was like, that's great, but that is not your class. Simple. And it continued. And once I realized that we are actually going into a little bit of a fighting mode and the group watches that, it needed to be changed.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, we're going to close that. We're going to walk. That was the longest walk I ever done in my class. Literally, the longest walk. The class after that went great. I did not change anything. But the walk, which is basically like a relaxing, or I call it the ginger, the one that cleans the palate between two sushi bites, was the longest walk I ever done in my class. More than 15 minutes only walking in between, sensing and grounding. Because that was a surprise attack, I was not grounded. Then it became clashing. Once I realized it's clashing, you stop it, you go back to grounding. And then I asked him after the class that we need to talk. Very simple. And of course, he came back after, it was fine. But you notice that once there is somebody who popcorn explode, your ears for what they're saying and your eyes for how they look in the class are much more sharp. And then you can do the Aikido better.
Yeah. Funny, there's also a practice called verbal Aikido. How to use the energy of someone, the verbal energy, to be directed. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it all boils down to purpose.
Yep.
Alignment and purpose and making sure why we're here together.
True.
Hello, listener. Are you tired of listening to my podcast voice praising our sponsor Session Lab in each episode? I think it's time to pass the mic over to you. So if you are as much of a Session Lab fan and user as I am, Please share your experience and praise, and don't be shy of add a sentence of self-promo. Send me your soundbite, and you might hear yourself on the next show and find your name and URL in the show notes. I'm looking forward to hearing from you.